Christian Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents If God is Love, Don't Be a Jerk, Finding a Faith That Makes Us Better Humans by John Pavlovitz, narrated by John Pavlovitz. Introduction. You had one job. Love is the greatest force in the universe. It is the heartbeat of the moral cosmos. He who loves is a participant in the being of God. Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. If you want a good laugh, Google the phrase, you had one job. The results are a hilariously tragic parade of seemingly impossible fails, unfathomably poor planning, and facepalm-inducing human error. A piece of melted cheese on top of a fast food burger bun. The word stop misspelled on a street crossing. A keep to the right sign with its arrow facing left. A toilet lid inexplicably installed below the seat itself. Seeing these stupefying train wrecks in task execution tends to elicit two responses, usually making you feel a little bit better about yourself while simultaneously wanting to track down the culprits in an effort to understand how they managed to neglect the primary duty assigned to them. We begin to speculate. Were they temporarily distracted? Did they not properly comprehend the instructions? Did they feel as though someone above them in the chain of command dropped the ball? Were they just plain lazy? When people miss the point so spectacularly, we want to know how and why, because that kind of failure feels impossible from the outside. It seems unfathomable to get the main thing wrong, and seeing it happen sparks our curiosity. I imagine Jesus knows well the curiosity that comes with watching people given clear direction lose their way. As a longtime Christian by aspiration, if not always in practice, I often envision an exasperated Jesus coming back and the first words out of his mouth to his followers as his feet hit the pavement being, "You had one job, love. So what happened?" I wonder what massive wave of excuses and rationalizations would come flooding from the mouths of the faithful multitude in front of him, how they might justify their mistreatment of the assailed humanity in their care, the verbal and theological gymnastics they'd attempt to avoid culpability for their own cruelty. Would they stridently recite him a verse from Leviticus? Would they blame the liberal media for morally corrupting America? Would they talk about people's wicked lifestyle choices? Would they argue that they were loving the sinners in their midst but simply hating their sin? Would they frantically offer up the same platitudes and parrot back the same partisan talking points they'd gotten used to brandishing on social media and proffering in Sunday school classes? And if all else failed to convince him, would they quote Jesus to himself in a desperate Hail Mary attempt to pass the buck to him for what they did or failed to do while supposedly standing in for him? And there, fully seen in the piercing gaze of the namesake of their very faith tradition, with all their justifications and excuses exhausted and only their fully exposed hearts left, would any of the responses be sufficient reasons for refusing to love when that was the singular task and primary commandment that he left them responsible for tending to? In my less compassionate moments, I admit that I like to picture it not going well for them. I know it's far less than admirable, let alone Christ-like, but some days my heart strangely warms at the possibility of a few billion brimstone-breathing evangelists, sanctimonious conservative politicians, and plank-eyed judgmental Christian neighbors all having to explain themselves in a sanctified flop-sweat moment they can't exegete or gaslight themselves out of, and they all get what they have coming to them. But my self-righteous revelry doesn't last long. The mirror calls me out as I remember what I think I know about Jesus, and that rescues me from full-blown, unabated hubris. I begin to wonder what my excuses might be, how I'd spin the enmity I manufacture here, what story I'd come up with for not doing the one task we both know comprises a disciple's job description. And if I really believe what I'm supposed to believe, are any of my justifications sufficient? If God is love, and if Jesus is the perfect expression of that love, and if I'm supposedly trying to follow that Jesus, how can I be so love-impaired so frequently? How do I miss the singular point so consistently? It's not as if I didn't know what I was signing up for, like some lengthy online user agreement I blindly accepted in haste, missing the bombshell fine print beneath. Having read the Gospels a few million times, give or take a few hundred thousand, I know the primary commandment is not something I need to excavate from cumbersome layers of foreign language translation and cultural mores of the time. Jesus himself clearly laid out the most important commandment for me and for everyone who's ever cracked open a Bible, and even most people who haven't but know the story anyway, so we'd all understand what's being asked of us going in. So there would be no post-altar call, buyer's remorse, or deathbed claims of a sucker punch bait and switch. Loving God and neighbor and self is the elemental stuff of Christian prayers, songs, t-shirts, and bumper stickers, and we know that. But as the master Morpheus said to protege Neo in the first and only truly great Matrix film, there is a difference between knowing the path and walking the path. Love is the path that Jesus laid out for us. I'm going to assume we agree on that, and we won't waste a lot of time arguing it here. This book is about the walking, about imagining what love should or could look like if we take that mandate seriously, about whatever it is that interrupts and derails us along the way. It's about the ways a bigger God is going to yield a greater capacity to love more people, and about what that stretching will cause us to confront and confess and jettison. It's going to eventually be beautiful, but not always pleasant along the way. It's no fun to face your failures, and I speak from a wealth of experience. Throughout my life, I have often imagined I was a Christian. I was raised in a Christian home and went to a Christian school. After a few meandering spiritual wilderness years as a skeptical but hopeful agnostic, I attended a Christian seminary, became a Christian pastor, and have served in Christian churches for most of the past 25 years of my life. Not enough Christian for you? No problem. I've got more. Along the way, I've read and studied and preached the scriptures extensively, led community Bible studies and student retreats and overseas mission trips, ministered in tiny rural chapels and massive gleaming megachurches. I've crisscrossed the country for the better part of 5 years, sharing the good news as I understand it. I've done all the religious stuff that proper Christians are supposed to do. As a result of these decades immersed in this tradition, both personally and vocationally, I thought I at least had the gist of Jesus, that I was in the blessed ballpark. Now I think I might have been doing this wrong all these years. Maybe I assumed something that I shouldn't have, because much of the time I don't quite feel like I fit in the places professed Jesus folk gather. I always thought Christians were supposed to care about people, not necessarily agree with them or believe what they believe or even like them, but to see them each as specific and unique image bearers of the divine and want to work for shalom for them. Wholeness, happiness, peace, safety, rest, regardless of where they came from or what they believed or who they loved. I grew up believing that one of the markers of a life that emulated Jesus was a pliable heart capable of being broken at the distress of other human beings, when they are hungry and hurting, when they are homeless and afraid, when they grieve and feel alone, when they believed they are unloved and forgotten, when tragedy befalls them and when injustice assails them. These things are supposed to move the needle within us if Jesus is softening our hearts, or at least I imagine so. Even in seasons of defiance and doubt, when I wasn't sure that Jesus was who they said he was or that I believed anything about salvation or damnation, I took that love your neighbor business seriously. In those obstinate backsliding seasons of rebellion, when I was what true disciples call a hopelessly lost sheep, I was sure that compassion was non-negotiable for Jesus' followers. I always knew that sacrificial love was the narrow road and the better path, that loveless Christianity was an oxymoron, and that if I ever claimed faith, I'd better be more loving than if I didn't. I bet you know all that too, which is why you're in disbelief that so many professed Christians neglect the one job of loving people, and why you're compelled to get it right. We need such human beings walking around now more than ever, given where we're headed, at least in America. I'm speaking these words in the last days of a COVID-ravaged, racism-scarred, election-battered 2020 that seems determined to squeeze in every bit of disaster it can before angrily departing into the annals of history future therapy bills, and the recurring nightmares of everyone who managed to live through it. Here in this current disorienting maelstrom of prolonged isolation, wild conspiracy theories, election fraud claims, and other assorted personal and national disasters too lengthy to list here, there are a whole lot of things that I don't know. I don't know if I'll spend a second birthday in quarantine. I don't know if my kids will homeschool through college. I don't know if I'll ever get to use my frequent flyer miles. I don't know if before the end of the year, Donald Trump is going to declare Mar-a-Lago a sovereign nation and himself its rightful king. But there is one thing about the future I do know right now, one coming reality that I can safely predict with 100% certainty, regardless of who assumes or retains the presidency, what the composition of Congress turns out to be, or whether there is a blue or a red majority in America. Loveless, Jesusless Christianity is going to leave us fractured in ways we've never been before. There's going to be relational collateral damage in families. Faith communities will be broken apart. Lifelong friendships will be irreparably harmed. Injustice will be prevalent. And hateful religion will have compounded it all. No political result on November 3rd, 2020 was going to change what was true on the day before, or on the day I'm speaking these words, or on the day you're hearing them. The calendar and the politicians are immaterial. These injuries we're tending to are all far bigger than partisan politics or national election results, and they won't be relegated to a single calendar year either. These are evergreen afflictions. For as long as human beings have been declaring devotion to a God of love, they have been gloriously screwing it up by being hateful in the process. The Bible doesn't shy away from that, and neither should we. If we've been paying attention, we know that for as much as religion has bent the arc of the moral universe toward justice, it has just as often pulled it into inequity. For whatever liberation has come via the people of Jesus, we have collectively engineered bondage and fortified supremacy as well. It's good to admit this as we try to fashion something better from what has been. It's necessary to see the ugly things in the shadowed places of our nation and in our faith tradition as we work to let a little bit of light in. That isn't going to be as easy or as neat or as comfortable as we'd like. I can understand why you might not want to accept the invitation I'm offering here. Lord literally knows I've avoided it for most of my life. It's a fairly simple and painless task to identify the people out there who we believe are doing religion wrong and condemn them. We can usually accomplish that with very little effort, and though it's a bit less pleasant, we might even be willing to document the ways and times in which we respond poorly to people and to circumstances. It's a far more invasive and disruptive endeavor to pause long enough and dig deep enough to consider what we actually believe and how that belief shapes our dispositions and directs our paths. That process leaves a mark. Most of us aren't looking for an existential crisis, but let's be willing to have one, to admit our questions, inventory our struggles, and attend to our burdens. You're likely having such a crisis whether you acknowledge it or not, otherwise you wouldn't be listening to this. And since you are, you're probably in some sort of deconstruction, reconstruction, or straight-up demolition of your former faith. You are in the emotional growing pains of adult spirituality. Re-examining your entire image of God is going to be a bit of an interruption, something you can't numb with a streaming binge or a couple hours of mindless slot machine scrolling through your newsfeed. When your previous understanding of whatever you imagine set life into motion and holds it all together and directs your movements faces disturbance, there are going to be consequences and cost and collateral damage. Many people don't want to do that invasive, uncomfortable work, which is why they're satisfied allowing someone else to tell them what to believe. I'm glad that, for whatever reason, you're not satisfied with that. Our world, starved for love, is glad too. Chapter 1. Unboxing God. Oh no, I'm trapped in these pants. That was the first thought I had as I careened wildly around my walk-in closet. It probably sounds as ridiculous to you now as it did in my head in that moment. The situation had deteriorated rapidly. Just 5 minutes earlier, I'd been quietly thumbing through the outer reaches of my clothes rack, far from the well-traveled middle section where outfits no longer suitable for respectable humans languish for years in dust and darkness before finally being evicted into cardboard boxes or garbage bags and sentenced to spend their remaining days in the attic or garage. As a series of once sensible and now tragically laughable fashion decisions slid past me, I stopped abruptly as I suddenly found myself face to face with a 30-year-old friend, a pair of ladies' stretch denim pants I'd purchased in 1988 at the Cherry Hill Mall in southern New Jersey. Author's note, I was 20 years old, had a long and luxurious mane of thick, naturally curly chestnut hair, and as the male singer in a local hair band, as they were affectionately known, there was absolutely nothing unusual about buying my clothes in a women's clothing store. As I stared reverently at the glorious, acid-washed relic of my youth gone wild, suddenly a voice in my head that strongly resembled my own said, "You know, I bet they still fit." Like the crafty serpent tempting Adam and Eve in the garden, the voice dared me forward. "Go ahead, try them on." At 51 years old, I still consider myself in pretty good shape, so I answered back with naive optimism, "Why not?" I was about to get a definitive answer. Things started off promisingly enough. I bent down and grabbed the waistband, stepped into the small leg holes that easily traversed my ankles, but by the time I reached my calves, I realized I was in trouble as progress slowed substantially. Undaunted, I doubled my resolve and pressed on, which turned out to be a really terrible idea. I was soon wriggling wildly, and my breathing became noticeably labored as I tried to muscle myself all the way into what had quickly become a pair of pale blue human sausage casings. When those efforts proved futile, I began to hop violently like a stationary sack race participant, hoping the blunt force of gravity would thrust my thighs the rest of the way through the now obviously woefully undersized space provided. After 4 or 5 desperate heaves, I felt a rush of air suddenly vacuum sealing me in and mercifully came to rest on the ground. I stood there with my chest heaving and my forehead perspiring as if having just completed high-intensity cardio training and initially feeling pleased with myself. However, any satisfaction was only a momentary victory as I felt the elastic waistband sharply digging into my skin and my legs started to quickly lose feeling due to lack of blood flow. It was then that I came to 3 sobering realizations. 1, I was no longer 20 years old. 2, I still hadn't fully exhaled. And 3, I wasn't getting out of these pants by myself. They say that the first step in getting help of any kind is admitting that you have a problem. I could tell from the substantial tension my lower extremities were under that if I tried to sit down in that moment, I'd surely set off a powerful explosion, sending spandex shrapnel into every corner of our walk-in closet. In a welcome moment of sober humility, I reluctantly called for help. Hearing my distant, muffled cries for assistance, my wife and kids came running in from other rooms of the house, expecting from the desperation in my voice that I'd had a bad fall or heart episode, and instead were greeted by a grown man imprisoned by his own pair of lady slacks. After they helped to extricate me, we all had a good laugh at my expense, and when sensation returned to my legs, I placed the pants, which had now shrunken back to their original size, back on the hanger. I wasn't ready to say goodbye to them just yet. If I had expired there in that closet, my cause of death would have been listed as unintentional spandicide caused by reckless arrogance. It would have been a classic case of user error. No one would have blamed the pants. They may have functioned back when I bought them, but they certainly weren't designed to contain me 30 years and 4 inches of girth later. I wasn't supposed to fit into them any longer and shouldn't have tried. That's how you find yourself in peril in your bedroom closet. This has been my spiritual journey over the past decade and a half, trying desperately to cram my belief into a space it was no longer capable of fitting into, hoping that Sheer will, a little denial, and lots of wishful thinking would allow me to stay in something I'd long outgrown but couldn't quite bring myself to admit did not fit anymore. There's a song church people have sung together for decades. Give me that old-time religion. It's good enough for me. Far from a ringing endorsement, by the way. But what do you do when that old-time religion isn't good enough for you anymore? When good enough is far less than what you are seeking in the deepest recesses of your heart? If I'm honest, the further I've walked into my adult life and the more open I've been to being surprised and to changing my mind and to considering better stories about spiritual things, the more organized religion has been an exercise in diminishing returns. God getting progressively bigger, while the space I'd once created to contain that God grows more and more restrictive, more and more suffocating. When you find yourself in that newly confining space, the fear and the guilt can be overwhelming and it can make you freeze. For years as a local church pastor, I stayed where I was, literally and figuratively, either because I thought something might give if I prayed hard enough, or maybe because I was too terrified to confront the reality that my faith was shifting. But the pressure was profound and constant. Something that was supposed to be life-giving suddenly became difficult to breathe inside of. You don't need to be a pastor or a Christian to understand spiritual claustrophobia because it is consistent in all existential crises, and it's more common than most of us admit or realize. In my travels, both online and around the country, I meet thousands of similarly squeezed people, human beings who still passionately crave the wide-open wonder of genuine spiritual pursuits and the transformative spaces of loving community, but who aren't finding those things in the religious stories and systems and buildings of their childhoods. Now that they're getting older, they're taking off the no longer useful hand-me-down theologies they inherited and looking for something that fits them today. These days, Sundays are different for them. Church is different, and God is different. But the yearning is still there, and the burden still twists their insides. They may be losing their old-time religion, but they haven't lost their hunger to find sacred spaces, to confront the persistent questions, to live in justice communities, to see realities deeper than the surface, or to participate in something greater than themselves. And this is where the journey to a more loving religion begins. Embracing the questions, discarding old stories, being humble enough to start again. Whenever people say, "I'm spiritual but not religious," this is usually another way of saying, "I've outgrown my God box and I'm currently looking for a bigger one." They're telling you that they've either willingly left or been evicted from the place they once called home, the geography of their former faith. They are wandering prodigals either by choice or by necessity. They may have discovered an irreconcilable difference with a theological position in their faith tradition, or grown exhausted from a silent response to injustice from the pews, or they simply woke up one day and realized they can't pray the prayers they used to and something has to give. I think most honest people of faith, every sincere sojourner, and lots of introspective human beings who are pressed up against the profound mysteries of this life and whatever might happen beyond its conclusion, are looking for a bigger God and for a tangible expression of goodness that feels proportional to that God. We all want something unbelievable to believe in, something that is so massive and so capable of surprising us that it is always just slightly out of reach and just a little beyond our capacity to comprehend. And we want something that makes us and the people around us better humans. If not, it's probably not worth our time. The moment someone tells you that they have this spiritual life figured out, that's a red flag that they're lying to you or to themselves. This book is for the rest of us. The restless, the unsettled, the unconvinced, and even the downright defiantly opposed. For people who want more love than they've encountered in organized religion. I think if we're doing faith right, we're supposed to be there. Evolving spirituality will always give people the desire to shed the skins of their current belief system, always push them to outgrow their present assumptions about the world, and it will forever be increasing their capacity for change. That expansion is necessary, but narrow religion will usually shrink everything over time until one day it all blows up. A few months ago, I got a frantic email from my friend Tiffany, who said she needed to talk as soon as possible. This was out of character for her, and the unusual urgency of her message moved me to reach for the phone. "I'm in free fall," she said almost immediately, and continued quickly, her voice breaking. "I feel like I have no ground to stand on right now." Then there was silence, broken only by quiet sniffs. I knew a good deal of Tiffany's backstory. A lifelong evangelical, raised Southern Baptist in Texas, she always had a tidy, clearly defined God box and a go-to set of scriptures she wielded like a rudimentary first aid kit for herself and others. In college, she'd met Scott, a local student pastor, and like a good, respectable Southern Baptist girl, soon became a Southern Baptist pastor's wife. For years, everything was perfect, or at least it worked for her given the story they'd told themselves, until she began to see hairline cracks forming in the bedrock of what she once believed. Their senior pastor's increasingly incendiary messages about the evils of the gay agenda, and her church's silence in response to a new wave of bathroom bill legislation, started to conflict with the LGBTQ people she'd met and come to love. As so often happens as we grow and get better stories, life begins to argue with our theology, and Tiffany was in the middle of that increasingly heated disagreement with her former self. Over the past few years, she'd gradually cut many of the tethers of her previous religious narrative, which at first felt freeing. That is, until her marriage began to go south and her youngest daughter became very sick. In the past, during times of emotional, financial, and relational crisis, she'd gone to the familiar religious places of refuge, and they weren't cutting it any longer. Tiffany said, "Before, when things fell apart, my very specific faith story was the thing I could hold on to. My image of God, my go-to Bible verses, those default prayers, the fallback platitudes, and my church family were all comforting." Her voice grew more desperate as sobs interrupted her. "Now that I don't have those things, what do I turn to? To people? To myself? To medication? I don't know what to anchor myself to anymore. I just feel like I'm drifting here." Tiffany was feeling the growing pains of an expanding spirituality, of outgrowing the box. She'd let go of the restrictive religious doctrine of her childhood and early adulthood and found that the tiny theological container was no longer big enough for her beliefs. But in a time of trauma, she struggled to find a suitable replacement. She was and is living with a new disorientation, one we should probably get used to. If we're going to find a bigger God, one that makes us more loving, we have to admit and address two fundamental realities. The first is that small religion is a problem. It is the culprit of the suffocation and the source of our frustration because it tends to thrive on separation and breed exclusion. We've all seen and experienced small religions, so that may be the easier of the two truths to reckon with. The second and much more challenging reality is that all religion is small religion. Yours, mine, that of the people you admire, and those you can't stand. The traditions you hold tightly to, and the ones you've long ago rejected. A God our brains and buildings can fully hold just isn't big enough to be truly God. The moment we imagine a rigid box adequately capable of containing the who, what, how, and why of everything that is or ever was or ever might be, is the moment we've shrunken all the answers to the elemental questions down into something that is no longer God-sized. If we can fully fathom it, it ceases to be worthy of our reverence. In writing to his church 2,000 years ago and to those who would follow them in this journey, the Apostle Paul writes a prayer that we as people of faith might grasp how wide and long and high and deep is the love of Christ, and to know this love that surpasses knowledge, that you may be filled to the measure of all the fullness of God. That seems like both a beautiful aspiration and an impossible task. If there is no mystery left in our belief system, we need to move into a space that will accommodate it. No matter how fervently we've prayed, how earnestly we've searched, how diligently we've studied, or how sure of ourselves.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?